Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today on the show, I speak with Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon, and one topic is what to do about education funding.
I think, you know, whether it's this year, next year, or the year after, it will be broken and we will have to do something.
Speaking of education, the Powell School District is dealing with an influx of special education students. The administration is concerned about how to deal with this influx in the future.
I do worry about when they talk about caps on certain programs or services.
And Deb Holland's confirmation hearings were must-see TV for many young Indigenous people.
Because we never, had a chance in the government, but now we can. She's, standing up for us, and she's trying to help us.
Join us for these stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Indian Country was watching this week as Congresswoman Deb Holland faced confirmation hearings to become the first Indigenous Secretary of the Interior. For many young tribal citizens across the region, this was must-see TV. The Mountain West News Bureau's Savannah Marr spoke to some of them.
17-year-old Jasmine Wildcat is a star student in Riverton, Wyoming, not the type to skip class. But on Tuesday, a piece of history was unfolding that she just couldn't miss.
The committee meets today to consider nomination of Representative Deborah Holland to be the Secretary of the Interior. It was so good to see
you. It is just super monumental, and it's just so inspiring to, you know, not only just me, but probably to other Native women.
I'm joining Jasmine on Zoom as she watches Holland give an opening statement and face her first round of questions. Jasmine's 22-year-old sister, Christy, is Zooming in as well. She points out that Holland is wearing traditional Pueblo jewelry.
She is really decked out in turquoise, if you must know.
There's no question that fossil energy does and will continue to play a major role in America for years to come.
See right there, I wonder if one of the committee members kind of sighed with relief.
Both Jasmine and Christy know that at least a few senators probably can't be won over.
They've already, you know, stereotyped her as radical.
The Wildcat sisters know a thing or two about being stereotyped as a radical Indigenous woman. They're citizens of the Northern Arapaho tribe and both have left-leaning politics. They grew up going to majority white schools in deep red Wyoming.
Yeah, Barras was talking. Can you just turn it up?
Right, he's your senator. So you guys must be interested in what he has to say.
Yeah.
Should the federal government continue to permit oil and gas wells in this country?
Yes, and I believe that's happening.
He's being super condescending.
I did not like any part of that. Just the way he was. He wasn't asking the question. It was more like of an attack.
Christy and Jasmine say this is more than usual partisan politics at a committee hearing. They recognize what Holland is facing from their own experience, times they've been the only Native woman in the room.
So seeing it on a federal level, it's mind-boggling.
Major eye roll. You're like, what's new? Even if I could get this high role, you're still going to talk down to me.
It's a dynamic they're familiar with, and they're taking notes on how Holland pushes back. A few hundred miles south in Holland's congressional district, students at Albuquerque's Native American Community Academy are also taking this in.
We are going to be talking today about the confirmation of Deb Holland.
That's history teacher Nick Filippi, a citizen of the Acoma Pueblo. He's leading a discussion with 15 or so of his middle schoolers on Zoom. He explains that the Interior Department plays a major role in the lives of Indigenous Americans.
So with that in mind, what kind of impact does this have on our communities?
I think that it's important and it's good that there's a Native American woman being heard.
Eighth grader Malila Deshini is a citizen of the Navajo Nation.
I think a lot of people are very, biased, I think, about Natives and or often associated with alcohol, not being very smart, kind of stuff like that.
The 13-year-old says Holland is living proof that those are just racist stereotypes, not rooted in reality. And she says she's glad that Native people will have a voice in the new presidential cabinet.
Because I think it's important for, like, all voices to be heard, not just one-sided stories.
Her classmate, 14-year-old Giuliano Harding, is also Navajo. He agrees.
Because we never, like, had a chance in the government, but now we can. She's, like, standing up for us, and she's trying to help us.
The following morning, Holland faced more tough questions from senators in the second and final round of her confirmation hearing. Back in Wyoming, the Wildcat sisters were trying to tune in between their schoolwork. Both young women have big dreams. They say Holland makes their aspirations tangible.
I realize that, you know, I can do whatever I want. Christy can do whatever she wants. You know, she can eventually be president. Because
it's just awesome because I can see myself in her and I'm like, okay, well, she put her mind to it. Like, I aspire to be like that someday.
As they pursue their goals, Christy and Jasmine Wildcat say Deb Holland gives them a real person to admire and a real path to follow. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Savannah Marr.
Wyoming's Missing Murdered Indigenous Persons Task Force unveiled its findings last month. The reports show that the problem is much bigger than previously recognized, and that the media has not done a good job of addressing the violence in Wyoming communities. Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner reports.
Nicole Wagon knew something was wrong days before she would get the news.
I didn't feel good. I didn't feel good for those couple of days. What I can explain to you is leading up to the day I received the call, it just felt like a sense, a feeling, and I couldn't shake it.
She knew Jocelyn was planning a road trip, thought about going over to visit her, but decided against it. Their visits sometimes went on a long time with all the talking and laughing. And then the next day she got the call.
And I received a call that day from my aunt, and I could hear it in her voice. And it was full panic of, where are you? Get to Jocelyn's house now. And I already knew. I already had not a good feeling. And just connecting everything, coming together. As soon as I got to my daughter's residence and seeing all law enforcement, I knew it wasn't good.
It was a few days after New Year's 2019. Police officers were dispatched that afternoon as holiday snow clung to Christmas lights. Nicole is unable to describe the feeling of losing a child, but she still tries.
And it was total shock. And it's very devastating, and it's indescribable.
January 5th, 2019, Jocelyn Watt and her partner, Rudy Perez, were murdered. The crime is still unsolved 2 years later. Then, last year, Nicole Wagon lost another daughter, Jade Kelly. Again, Nicole knew something was wrong when Jade didn't show up to her older sister's annual memorial.
I know in my heart there's no way that she would have missed that. So I knew something was wrong.
Nicole reported Jade missing right away, but a month later, Jade was found. Jade's case is still under investigation by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Nicole remembers having to tell her other three daughters.
That memory stays etched into my mind of the devastation, to see the devastation on my daughter's faces again. And you can't take that pain away.
But Nicole hung on to her family and her faith and became an advocate for not only her daughters, but for missing and murdered Indigenous people all over the state of Wyoming and in Indian country. Nicole's message is one the tribal community has been trying to tell Wyoming leaders for years, but a new report is showing that Nicole's experience isn't an anomaly. Wyoming's Missing Murdered Indigenous Persons Task Force released their findings last month. Emily Grant is a research scientist at the Wyoming Survey and Analysis Center at the University of Wyoming. Grant immediately saw problems.
The data is not being recorded accurately, or maybe it's not being recorded at all.
The information Grant could find showed that there were 105 homicides of Indigenous people statewide between 2000 and 2020.
And they made up 21% of the total homicide victims in the state, which is surprising because they're less than 3% of the state population. So there's a very big disparity there.
And the problem isn't limited to the reservation. There was at least one missing Indigenous person reported in every Wyoming county over the last decade, except one. A total of 710 cases in Wyoming. But you wouldn't know that from the news. Grant says that the media favors stories about white victims. 51% of white homicide victims received coverage compared to the 30% of Indigenous homicide victims. And Indigenous women were the lowest at 18%. The study also found that when the victim was white, the media was less graphic about the state of the victim's body.
But in addition to the violent language, homicide victims that are Indigenous were more often portrayed in a negative light, sharing negative information about their personal life that isn't directly related to the crime itself.
Grant says in stories about Indigenous victims, the media included negative details about substance abuse or unemployment. She says details like this add to people's implicit bias about Indigenous people. Emily says putting together this report wasn't easy. Information was often inaccurate, locked behind a paywall, or non-existent. And the COVID-19 pandemic didn't help data recovery either. Kara Chambers is the chair of the task force and the director of victim services in Wyoming. She says originally they planned to do in-person interviews, but the pandemic made that impossible.
And as we know, the pandemic was really disproportionately impacting the reservation in our state, and they had really shut down almost immediately out of self-preservation and out of an abundance of caution.
But Chambers says that the task force refused to let the pandemic stop their progress. She says it was too important to tell people's stories.
You know, having a background in victim services, I wanted to make sure that we weren't just focusing on data and numbers and statistics.
Jocelyn and Jade are buried in Arapaho at the St. Stephen's Mission. Nicole hopes the national attention to the problem is finally affecting change. Recently, there's been a warrant out for a suspect in Jade's murder case. Nicole says she's not going to quit on her daughters because they wouldn't quit on her.
If this happened to me, I know my daughters would be fighting tooth and nail for me. So I fight for justice for them as well.
You can read the full report at wyomingpublicmedia.org. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Taylor Stagner.
Coming up, we will have a story about a tax that you might not have heard about. This is Open Spaces.
This time on The Modern West, small town politics might have a lot to teach about how fragile democracy has become.
The two commissioners we got this year, no one ran against them. Well, if there's no competition and no one from the other side pointing out what can be changed, that's when you get the blind spots.
It's part 11 of our ghost towning series, Find the Modern West, under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org, sponsored by Sheridan Travel and Tourism.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. The pandemic has caused huge revenue shortfalls in state budgets across our region and country. And in some places, that's meant a renewed conversation about taxes. But one of those conversations may not be what you expect. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen explains.
So a story about taxes. You may be thinking this is going to be a lot of numbers or maybe a bit boring. But what about awkward? Or taboo.
It still is something that, you know, gets whispered about.
That's Jen Simon, and she's talking about periods. Simon is with the Wyoming Women's Action Network, and she says that cultural stigma prevents important public policy discussions. For example, affordability.
So if you can't actually afford products, you might not go to school. On those days. So you might miss out on part of your education. You might not be able to go to work on those days. So you might miss out on income. It's really incredibly problematic.
So what does someone's menstrual cycle have to do with the debate about taxes?
The Revenue Committee is called to order, and our first bill
is it Senate File 27? Is that the right number?
Well, for the Wyoming legislature, it came up during a January Revenue Committee meeting. Republican Senator Affie Ellis presented a bill to exempt menstrual products from taxation, but the bill didn't even make it out of committee.
On the Senate side, I knew that the bill would likely not advance. Wyoming has significant budget issues that we're dealing with right now, and so any loss or foregone revenue collection I knew would be a challenge.
If it had been signed into law, Wyoming would have joined a minority of states in the U.S. that exempt menstrual products from taxes. Laura Strassfeld is with Period Equity, a nonprofit legal organization that's working on what they call menstrual equity.
And by that, we mean working to make sure that menstrual products are free and accessible and safe.
Traditionally, menstrual products have included things like tampons, pads, and liners. In recent years, other products like the menstrual cup and even period underwear have gotten more popular, with people seeking out environmentally friendly options. Prices range from around $10 a month for tampons to roughly $35 for a menstrual cup. But in most states, one thing is the same.
They still tax menstrual products.
In the Mountain West, Nevada is the only state to specifically get rid of the tax. That was back in 2018. Strassfeld says she'd like to see more states do that, especially since the problem also disproportionately impacts people on a limited income.
Because they're purchased in small quantities, they can't be purchased in bulk and online, and the prices are higher in places where poor people buy these products. So I challenge anyone to find a more regressive tax than the tampon tax.
Is it more complicated than that? Catherine Lawhead thinks so. She's with the Tax Foundation, a nonpartisan tax policy research organization. She says taxing menstrual products does make sense.
An ideal sales tax is one that has a broad base, but as low of a rate as possible in order to cover government services that are provided. Now, a lot of goods have been exempted over time, often for political reasons.
Those goods run the gamut, from hair loss products and private jet parts to gun club memberships and donuts. And Lawhead says making those exemptions is not the best approach.
Because that results in a sales tax base that picks and chooses different things. It's a smaller base, and that leads to higher rates over time.
And then there's the timing. We're in an economic downturn right now.
Now, of course, is a time when we are seeing a lot of revenue uncertainty. And so it does make sense to be extra cautious about what we are doing to the tax code.
In Wyoming, at least, the discussion has died down to a whisper once again. Though it's possible if it picks back up, the debate won't be just about taxes. Across the pond, Scotland just became the first country in the world to make menstrual products free to anyone who needs them. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
When Wyoming resident Celeste Armstrong had her driver's license suspended a year ago, she had no way of knowing that her case could completely change the way licenses are suspended. But the University of Wyoming's Defender Aid Clinic took up her case and eventually won in Albany County District Court. Clinic Director Professor Lauren McLean and student attorney Nathan Yanchek demonstrated that the Department of Transportation had been using the wrong law to suspend licenses. Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor spoke with McLean about what this means for Wyoming drivers.
Had a speeding ticket that occurred in the city of Laramie. She has a Wyoming driver's license, so an in-state license. She's driving within the state of Wyoming. Of course, when she's in Laramie, she gets a speeding ticket. That speeding ticket eventually goes unpaid. And at some point in time, when you have unpaid tickets, the Department of Transportation can take action against your license, which is exactly what happened with Ms. Armstrong. They sent a notice to her indicating that they wish to suspend her license for this unpaid ticket. And of course, the big issue here is the notice indicated that they were suspending her license under the non-resident violator compact. And so
getting a speeding ticket, not paying it, having your license suspended, that seems more or less like a normal sequence of events. So what is weird about this case specifically?
Yeah, I mean, what's weird about it is her suspension letter indicated that her license was being suspended under the non-resident violator compact. And so that's indicative of somebody who is either a non-resident of Wyoming or is indicative that you might have some kind of out-of-state problem that went unresolved. The notice is, you know, very narrow on what you can challenge. And so drivers aren't put on notice like, well, what if this whole thing, this whole non-resident thing is completely incorrect? Well, they're not, the notice doesn't really give them an opportunity to even think that that's something they could bring up at the hearing. So this is a very confusing suspension letter to receive when you're an in-state driver with an in-state ticket that's hanging up your license.
So tell me about the result, the ruling in this case.
We very firmly believe that one cannot be prosecuted for driving under suspended license unless that underlying suspension is valid. The city of Laramie disagreed with that, and so we had to litigate this. So the end result was a good result for Ms. Armstrong. Ultimately, Judge Crickin of Albany District Court, we believe, ruled correctly and decided that the non-resident violator compact did not apply to in-state drivers with in-state problems, basically. That instead, it would apply to Ms. Armstrong if she got a ticket in Colorado, and Colorado contacted Wyoming and said, hey, one of your drivers really messed up here. We want you to suspend the license. Or let's say Ms. Armstrong was a resident of Colorado and driving in our state and did something that was problematic.
Does the process or the reality for the person with the suspension look different if the state uses something other than this non-resident compact?
So under the NRVC, your suspension is indefinite until you fix the issue. Versus if you are suspended under, I think it's statute 317-129, that's the state statute for these kinds of tickets, then you're only suspended for 1 year.
So I imagine this win in the courtroom is a big deal for Armstrong, but what does it mean for Wyoming residents or Wyoming drivers more generally?
I think what it means is that, you know, no longer can the Department of Transportation just, you know, under this sort of blanket rule that doesn't even apply, suspend your license for one unpaid parking ticket or speeding ticket that occurs in the state of Wyoming on your in-state driver's license. So the Department of Transportation, I think, has lost some power in many respects. It calls upon them to have more accountability and to use the law properly. What we hope is that there'll be less suspension orders now because they'll have less opportunity. So there should be less suspensions now as a result of this, and certainly more clarity in the suspension letters that drivers receive.
Well, thank you for taking the time to tell me all about this today.
Yeah, thanks for your interest.
In the next segment, we'll have a story about an explosion of special ed students in one school district in the state and the district's concern about how to address the population in the future, plus a conversation with Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Human Nature, Damon faced trauma growing up in his small village in Alaska. His goal was to play pro basketball, but reaching for his dreams revealed an even larger purpose.
My senior quote was, "If all I'm remembered for is being a good basketball player, I've done nothing in my life."
Beyond the court. I'm Erin Jones. Find Human Nature under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming's legislature meets next week, and among the topics will be education spending and, of course, budget cuts in general. Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon joins me and begins the conversation by discussing some of the budget challenges the state is facing.
You know, we don't have the revenues. We need to make adjustments in programs. I made a large talk about, you know, there's not much fat left. We'd already Even Governor Meade cut pretty substantially. So we've had several years of declining budget, and we're getting right down to the bone. And some of the programs that we had to look at, you know, were in health. And people say, well, why did you focus on health? We didn't focus on health. Health makes a very large part of the budget. And if you're going to have to make these reductions, you're going to have to, you know, look at health. And some of these programs like seniors, that was a tough place to have to make those cuts. So we tried to figure out ways that we could address the issues, but we're down to the very bare bones. And you know, there are a lot of new legislators that came in this year. Many of them made no new tax pledges. I think they need to spend a little bit of time with the budget to understand exactly the problems that we face with the state going forward. So I don't think we can continue to cut, but we don't really have any other options right now.
I know one of the things you've always suggested might be a great idea is to look at exemptions. The committee that handles those, the Revenue Committee over on the House side, has consistently rejected some of those things. This week, they said no to lifting the sales tax exemption to data centers. What is the breaking point where finally something gets done there?
That's a very good point, and I share that same frustration that we never, once we pass an exemption, we never extinguish it. And I can remember going back early before coal really took off in 2001, 2002, John Schiffer talking about, senator at that time, talking about, well, maybe we can let off a little bit on our sales tax on food, for example, but we'll just do it as a holiday. And of course, it never is a holiday. I think we're really close to the breaking point at this point, but as I've pointed out over the last few years, that I think people in Wyoming don't realize just exactly how challenged we are. So that's been a big push for me this session, is to say, let's simplify this so that we have one checkbook and one savings account.
And what you're talking about there is an example. We've heard legislators over the years talk about one-time money. We can build this building because we've got one-time funds. You're saying don't do things like that.
I think we really need to look at the budget much as we do in our own household. If there's something that we think we can build but we can't maintain it, we shouldn't be building it. We should probably use those resources elsewhere.
He's Governor Mark Gordon. Let me ask you about the big one. We'll get right to it. Education. There was a recalibration committee that I, in my read of your words last year, you had high hopes would come with some proposals. They came with a bill that many are wondering if it's constitutional or not. It could cut $100 million out of education. Also, maybe set the stage for future revenue to pay for that. But you know, as I look at that bill, it doesn't look like a great solution to me. I'm just curious your read.
Well, I don't really think they got to the issues. I think the legislature is looking at what it takes to fund education. And I know there are a number of us that are saying, what is it that we want education to do? So there's some talk about the basket of goods and other things. I'm particularly interested in sort of stepping back from this eternal question of, you know, is there a way we can revisit the Campbell cases? Is there a way that maybe the courts will say, gosh, you don't have the money you used to, so you're okay to cut the funding? And actually approach it a little bit differently. What are the customers really wanting from education? Is that business? Is that parents? Is that taxpayers? And that's kind of where I'm hoping maybe this discussion goes, because I think you're right. This bill, I think the legislature has sort of four alternatives, and I'll let people sort out what they think is likely. One is that really not much gets accomplished. We wait another year. Another is a compromise can be reached, which is some cuts and maybe some revenue enhancements. There's a possibility, I suppose, that the full $100 million will be cut, and then there's, you know, probably far less likely opportunity for taxes to be raised. So I think we're, and as I said, you know, earlier this year, the governor has no ability, nor does the superintendent, to adjust the spending rate until we really don't have enough money. And that's, in my mind, a little bit of madness, because we really should be ratcheting people's expectations to what our means are.
It seems that if you went back to court and you lost, which you are, I think, 0-4 as a state lifetime on school funding, I'll just point that out for those of us scoring at home. But if you went back and you did, in fact, lose, then the whole debate, doesn't it become around what the court is saying you have to do and how you manage that versus maybe coming back this summer and say, once for all, let's just look at overhauling this whole thing and do it cost-based, follow the rules that were set out before, and come up with maybe a more modernized system. Do you think that's a possibility?
Well, that's my hope, actually, Bob, is I think maybe go back, look at the whole thing top to bottom again. That's a little bit of what I'm talking about with what are the customers' expectations as opposed to how do we fund this. I think there is this notion that Campbell said, which is probably an appropriate thing, that you have to fund education before you fund anything else that isn't constitutionally mandated. And I think at that time we were equating better education with more money spent, and maybe there's a different way to look at that.
What's interesting, had you not had the CBM boom, you actually probably would have developed a revenue source outside of energy to fund education. That's at least my recollection of the case at the time. And so it just seems like you're having a difficult time explaining to people that you have to pay for education. And so that's why you're taking out of reserves right now.
Yeah, and I think the mechanisms were put in place, Bob, during those years to really guarantee education funding. And that's a little bit of the legacy we're dealing with now. We had no anticipation that we would see kind of the revenue shortfalls that we have witnessed over the last couple of years. And so we really know how strained that apparatus is now. I think, you know, whether it's this year, next year, or the year after, it will be broken and we will have to do something.
And that's unfortunately the way it's worked in the past, isn't it? Is that we wait for things to break, and you know, that'll be exciting, won't it?
Well, Bob, that's the point that I've tried to make, is that's not a very sensible way to run education.
Governor Mark Gordon visiting with us. Last thing for you, what are you being told about COVID, and where are we heading as a state?
Well, we've done very well. We're really looking optimistically at spring, where we can start to have rodeos again, the college finals in Casper, Cheyenne Frontier Days, the other rodeos, Jubilee Days, etc. We'd love to see those go off without a hitch. We're really working hard to make that happen. And the progress we're seeing is taking us in that direction. Frankly, Bob, I spoke with some old colleagues on the Kansas City Fed last week, a week ago, and we were talking about roughly $1.8 trillion sitting on the sidelines, ready to be used for vacation. So a huge backlog of people wanting to get out and travel. With the vaccination program going as it is in Wyoming and elsewhere in the country, I think we should have a much better chance at it this coming year.
It's Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon. Governor, thank you so much, and enjoy the legislative session, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
At the start of this school year, Park County School District No. 1 in Powell welcomed an influx of new special ed students. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska has a story on how this sudden growth put pressure on the district to make sure that they could meet the students' needs.
Throughout this past summer, the school administration in Powell was focusing on how to reopen schools safely for their students amid the pandemic. Then, Ginger Sleep, the district's special services director, says their department got another surprise.
Coming into this school year, we knew that we would have students, which we love having students in Park One. We just didn't know, you know, the magnitude of those needs and just the quantity.
Close to 40 new students with special needs enrolled in the district. 20 of those were from out of state.
Every student has individual needs, and we're required by law to meet their needs, and we want to meet their needs to the best of our ability.
The district advertised for a special ed teacher, but received no qualified applicants. So they increased some hours of existing staff and hired some part-timers to pick up the slack. But the special ed teachers didn't only have to deal with an influx of students. They also had to learn how to help those students while wearing a mask and social distancing.
A lot of what we do for students, you know, we're sitting next to them, helping them as they work on their computer, helping them as they're taking notes.
That's Amy Fulton. She's a special education teacher at Powell Middle School. She says at the beginning of the school year, it was pretty stressful, but they've managed to figure out workarounds.
Barton reading and spelling system, it's very hands-on. It involves manipulating tiles with letters on them. It involves sitting close with a student, you know, and they have to be able to see your mouth a lot of times when you make those sounds.
Fulton says they have no other choice than to sit further away with their masks on, take breaks, and sanitize the tiles. And she says it works. Students are adapting to the new rules.
I'm Malin Corbin Harbison, but I usually just go by Corbin.
Corbin Harbison is one of those new students that joined the district this year. Her family moved from Montana, and Corbin struggled with the mask at first.
Because it just fogs up my glasses, and then I'm trying to clean my glasses off and then pay attention.
She found a mask that has a wire on it, so it doesn't fog up her glasses anymore. And she's happy she's in the classroom and can see that her paraeducators are still able to help her.
If I didn't have a para for some of my classes, I probably wouldn't have that good of a grade. Because they've helped me a lot, especially in like math and English, and especially in science, they've helped me keep my grade up.
Since October, 12 more new special education students have enrolled in the district. Ginger Sleep thinks part of the reason is because the Powell schools have remained open to in-person classes. And she's happy so many people are recognizing the district's abilities. But if this uptick continues, she's worried that her budget will not be able to handle it, especially as the legislature is talking about big education cuts this year.
I do worry about when they talk about caps on certain programs or services, and I just, you know, worry that we have an influx of students.
Another problem is that it's hard to plan ahead. The district can't tell if this trend will continue. If it does, Sleep says they have no other choice than to provide services to these students because of federal law. But it's unclear whether they need to keep on hiring special ed teachers or not.
When we have an influx, we have to respond. And when we don't have that staff available, we're going to have to request, you know, more, saying, hey, this is a need that wasn't present the year before. You're funding us at this level, but this student requires this amount of service.
Currently, the special education program is funded by federal grants and state funds. Sleep says no matter what, they will be innovative and figure out how to continue to provide the best aid to their students. But their challenges will be greater if the district has its budget slashed. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Wyoming's economy has depended on energy for a long time, but that formula might not be successful into the future, and entrepreneurship may be one of the answers to the state's diversification problem. The state has created startup challenges in order to try and foster more small businesses, and now it's even reaching high school students. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler visits Buffalo High School, where some students are just beginning their careers.
Buffalo High School sophomore Cadence Ingling says growing up, she thought she wanted to be a doctor.
Because I really love helping people. And then ever since I started taking business classes, I kind of just came to the conclusion that I want to be able to own my own business and kind of do my own thing.
That business class was with her teacher, Cammie Kennedy. Kennedy teaches business classes at Buffalo High School and advises the Future Business Leaders of America chapter.
My whole goal is that they're going to be able to accomplish and continue to grow and develop businesses, but I think they'll be like really like 15 years ahead of where I was starting. So I think that just gives them that opportunity, because I really believe that entrepreneurship is experience.
So it was a no-brainer when the Sheridan Startup Challenge got going in 2017 that Kennedy wanted to use that experience for her class. She had her students start applying to the entrepreneurship competition for practice.
We do this in class every day. I mean, we talk a lot about ideas and, you know, writing things down and solving problems, really, is what we're always focused on. And so let's go ahead and share some of our solutions out there.
The challenge is for entrepreneurs to compete for funding and business support. And in Sheridan, it's put on by Impact 307, one of the University of Wyoming's three business incubators across the state. Its goal is to encourage economic diversification. Impact 307 director Scott Rendell says while students from Buffalo have applied each year, none had been selected as a semifinalist by the judges.
But they were pretty intrigued by some of the ideas the students had this year. And so the idea came up in the Sheridan Startup Challenge judging process that, hey, maybe let's continue to cultivate that spirit of entrepreneurship down there. Maybe we create their own student startup challenge.
So after the 2020 Sheridan competition ended, Rendell and his team worked with Kennedy and put together the seed funding, around $5,000, half of which was donated by local businesses in Buffalo. Rendell worked with the students to prepare their business plans. He gave them critiques and helped them sharpen their presentations.
We polished their value proposition in terms of what their product and service is supposed to do. We talked about their market. We talked about a financial model. You know, how do they expect to make money with their idea? Then the pitch day was before the judge panel, and the judges had a whole number of additional questions for them.
Since the initial pitch event, Rendell is continuing to work with the four finalists on their business plans, and there will be another chance for students to win funding to get their ideas up and running. Sophomore Ingling is one of the finalists, and her business idea is to revamp day planners.
I found a lot of planners are super generic, or they're either like way over the top and kind of confusing. And so I kind of wanted to create and design something that is not only simple, but also kind of has that touch of creativity as well.
Part of Ingling's plan is to pitch her planner design to Buffalo High School. Through this process, she's learned a lot about the effort it takes to be a business owner.
It feels really good. I didn't think that I was going to be a business owner, that I'm only 15 and a sophomore. And so it's kind of weird because not a lot of kids are like that. But it's really cool just kind of to see that you can do those things. And also it's kind of like a maturity level. Like, it's just really cool to kind of see myself grow and evolve like that.
Rendell says even if these students don't end up pursuing these businesses for the long term, there are lifelong lessons.
I think no matter what they end up doing in the future, these are valuable life skills that will help them understand what it takes to run a business, what it takes to make a profit, what it takes to satisfy a customer.
Rendell says he and Kennedy have learned some lessons from this first experience, like not holding the presentations during finals week. He says working with these students has been its own challenge, with all the classwork and activities competing for their attention.
If we can work out the kinks, work out the bugs with this process here, why wouldn't we start it in Sheridan High School? Why wouldn't we start it down in Natrona High School where we have another incubator? That will be the idea, and if I can kind of perfect the model of how to get students engaged and produce some really good plans, I think it's going to be wonderful for the state to be able to develop these young entrepreneurs.
Rendell says they'll be wrapping up this competition soon and begin making plans for the next. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Buffalo.
When we come back, we will wrap up the program. This is Open Spaces.
One thing we're proud of here at Wyoming Public Media is our podcasts. Whether you're looking for a good story from human nature,
I was convinced some of them are going to die,
or you want to hear our region in unexpected ways through the Modern West.
When women teach women, we're saving relationships one cast at a time.
We've got a whole world waiting for you online. Explore under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. A 17th century book known as Bomfield Manuscript is giving insight into the lives and priorities of people of the past. Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel spoke with UW professor Peter Perelin, who analyzed the manuscript.
It's one of a large number of surviving manuscripts of this sort from the 17th, 18th century. They were kept within a household. They were clearly passed down over generations where different members of the household would write in them. Primarily, I think it's fair to say, they wrote recipes for dishes, culinary recipes, and they wrote recipes for medicinal remedies. So now we already have a problem because in our times, we don't publish books that have, you know, a recipe for baked Alaska alongside a recipe for what to do if you have an open sore on your knee, right? That's kind of gross to think about putting those things together. So we're clearly looking at a world of household wisdom in which different kinds of recipes were thought worth recording. Those two primary kinds of entries are culinary and medicinal recipes, but also you get all kinds of other bits of information. People write poems and put them in these books. People will write lists of almost like laundry lists of to-do lists, financial charts, all kinds of things like that. They'll record births and deaths in a family. When I started doing this kind of scholarship, I thought I'm looking at early modern cookbooks. But it's not right to say that that's what we're looking at. We're looking at something different that does have cookery recipes, yes, but it's a genre that we don't have a precise equivalent for in our world, and that makes it fascinating.
That's very cool. It does seem a little scatterbrained, though.
I think because realms that we have separated out when we think about what it means to live a life in 2021, they hadn't separated out. They aren't separate realms. It's, say, the realm of the early modern kitchen was the place where you cooked your chicken dinner, and it was also the place when somebody was bleeding or when somebody had an internal ailment. That was the place where the remedy was put together. You didn't pull somebody to the local doctor's office or hospital. You did it at home if you at all could, supported by the expertise that lay underneath your roof. So when a Mary Bomfield or a Catherine Thatcher or an Abraham Summers, which is another name in the manuscript, when they're contributing these recipes, they're imagining themselves as putting down wisdom for how to take care of the household, whether that's your bodily health or your appetite for food. They're putting down, how do you take care of this household today? And also, how do I share my wisdom from today with maybe the next generation or two generations down the road? These books are amazing because you can see them travel through the generations of a family.
So do you think that traveling and handing it down, do you think that kind of speaks to them thinking about the future? Or why would they hand it down versus not have their own recipe book for each generation of the family?
Oh, that's a good question. Here's a place where we can make modern connections. We pass recipes down in our own families. We share them on friend networks. If you go to a potluck and somebody brings a dish that you love, you say, please give me that recipe. I have recipes in my kitchen that are written in my mother's handwriting or my grandmother's, and it's very meaningful to me if I'm making my mother's recipe for Nanaimo bars, which is a West Coast Canadian delicacy that I always loved when I was a kid. So I feel like she's with me, even though she's not alive anymore, when I'm working with her recipe. So I feel like that's part of what's going on in these early modern manuscripts. And then there's also, you know, you don't have computers, you don't have the internet, you don't have smittenkitten.com to find wonderful recipes, right? You have to build your own database of recipes in the early modern kitchen. And it is a way, especially for the women who had the kitchen as a central realm, it's a way of writing themselves into being, of saying, I matter. I have something to offer. I have information that my family will like and that some future reader who may not even be born yet will benefit from. I don't want to overstate that. I don't think these writers thought of themselves as great literary producers, but I do think when you write down instructions for somebody to follow in the kitchen, you are asserting yourself a little bit. In fact, that's kind of the central thing that I was interested in the article that I wrote on the Bomfield manuscript, was to investigate how these manuscripts allow the individual voice to emerge, when clearly they're collective manuscripts. A lot of different voices put them together. The collective wisdom of the household goes into them. The kind of generic things that anybody knows or should know are in these manuscripts. But at the same time, you get these eruptions of distinctive, interesting, individual voices where you think, oh, here's a young girl who's trying something out for the first time, and she's figuring out who she can be and maybe how she's going to follow in her mother's footsteps, but carve a slightly different role for herself in the household than her mother carved. So I do think that the manuscripts give us these beautiful glimpses into early modern personalities.
Yeah, well, and kind of along with that, so you had said recipes.
Mm-hmm.
In your essay, it said receipts.
Yes.
What is the difference and which is technically correct?
I love that you asked that question. When I say recipes, I'm using the modern term. Recipes, here are the ingredients, here are the steps that you take, here's what you're going to ultimately produce. And the early modern term that shows up in the manuscript is receipt. And they can be synonymous, but there's also I think there's an interesting difference of emphasis in the term receipt. It means something that you have received. And I love the term receipt because that puts the recipes into networks of circulation. I received this recipe from my mother. It's a recipe, but it's also a receipt. And it shows this relationship that has happened. And if I share it with somebody else who's received it from me, it's a receipt. And the line that starts with my mother, or maybe it starts with whoever gave her the recipe to start with, now goes through me to this other person, and these networks expand. So when we talk about receipt, we're talking about movement. We're talking about kinetic communities, and I think that's really, really cool. A receipt talks about transmission, movement, energy, and that's a nice way to think about these earlier worlds as well as our own.
All right. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ivy. It's been a pleasure.
Peter Perelin is the dean of the UW Honors College. His essay on the Baumfield manuscript can be found in the Early Modern Studies Journal.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. You can hear the entire program or individual segments on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can also get our podcast at all the usual places. Anna Rader is our digital editor. All of our stories are also shared on our Facebook page, and you can also find us on Instagram and all of our reporters on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.